What kind of Messiah would one have if one had only the book of Micah? Hello, I'm Alden Thompson for Good Word. My conversation partners again are Dave Thomas and John Dibdall. And we've decided that it would be a good idea to say just a bit more about the historical context of the prophets that we've been dealing with. Jonah, Amos, Hosea, Micah. These are all people who were right on the edge of the fall of the northern kingdom. Now, there used to be just one kingdom. David and Solomon ruled over just one kingdom. That kingdom split apart in 931. The kingdom of the north, 10 tribes typically, kingdom of the south, Judah. But it was the kingdom of the north that went crashing down. And Micah, while he served both nations, the north and the south, also was a contemporary of Isaiah. Now, Isaiah continued on. He was in the south. But this is the complex that we have with prophets deeply concerned about the collapse of the worship of Yahweh. And we're going to focus on those questions now. And I want to pick up now that my opening question about the question of Messiah, because there's an interesting verse in Micah 5:2 that implies that something exciting was going to happen. Verse 2, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." Now, if you heard that in Micah's day, what kind of expectation would you have about the Messiah? It's not mentioned as Messiah here, but certainly that is one of the facets that was applied to Jesus in New Testament times.
A pretty grand personage. In other words, a ruler, transhistoric, from ancient of days, so I think you would have a fairly grand idea of a Messiah.
Yeah, I think the things that stand out, of course, are the rulership, which is clearly there, and the going forth from of old. It's not clear exactly what that means, but you get certainly that this is not a normal kind of person.
See, what has intrigued me enormously in the study of the Messianic prophecies in the Old Testament is that when Jesus picked up Isaiah 53 and applied it to himself, that's the suffering servant song, nobody wanted to believe it. In fact, nobody believed that Jesus, that the Messiah would die until after the resurrection. They all expected a Messiah. And it would be very interesting if we could explore that question. We probably don't have time here. But how it was that, guided by the Spirit, Jesus went into the prophetic passages of the Old Testament and selected the gentle suffering servant rather than the conquering king. And I'm struck by something that I've seen in life. I don't know how you men would see the same thing, that it's typically our most important lessons come from the difficult times. We get excited about all the good things that the Lord has promised, but when we look back, we recognize that He was there leading us through those difficult times, and the most difficult times are the things that we learn the most. Do you agree with that?
I think I would agree with that.
I would agree.
Difficulties cause us to stop and to pause, and if things are going well, we tend to keep rushing on. And I think the difficult times cause us to be more reflective, to seek God more diligently, to be more open to realizing that we may not have handled everything correctly. So I think that's certainly true.
Okay. Let's take a look at then another passage in Micah, unless we only have the one week for Micah. So if you guys have burdens coming
out. Well, I'm just going to say that the emphasis in the New Testament is upon the location of the Messiah.
It doesn't talk much.
When this is used, this is not talking about the rulership or the from eternity. It's talking about the location. and it mentions Bethlehem, Ephrata, because there were two Bethlehems, mm-hmm. and it specified which Bethlehem was going to be. So that was the purpose of it.
So what do you make of this? Is this a precise prediction about where Jesus would be born?
Certainly Matthew took it as so, and this one does, unlike the other one where it's clearly a historical statement. This is talking, I think, about the future. Mm-hmm. And so there was a tradition in Judaism already, even before Christians applied it, that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. So it is not just a Christian reading back into the Old Testament. The Jews already believed it on the basis of
this. It came from this, yeah.
But the amazing thing is that everybody expected a Messiah. Based on the Old Testament. And the passages are there that indicate clearly the prophet, the branch, the root, all of those are metaphors that clearly indicate that someone's coming. The only question that Jesus addressed was what kind of Messiah? And I think of one of Micah's contemporaries, Isaiah. Now, this is one that Jesus quoted in the synagogue, Isaiah 61. Again, it's a promise about someone who is to come and actually uses the word anointed, which would be Messiah. But it's really quite intriguing to read that and notice where Jesus puts the period. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners. Period. The next line says, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God. See? And that may have been part of the reason when his audience was ready to hear. And then he stops and doesn't give that. So it's a very tantalizing question. But for me, I'm convinced that it's the story of Jesus and his ministry to human beings. And that's why he picked up the first part of this. The Lord has called me, anointed me, to help those who are poor and needy. And in that respect, he certainly touches in with the primary message of the prophets. Okay, any other comments on that one before I'd like to take a look at another passage in Micah? But if you folks have...
Go ahead.
Okay? We'll let you do it.
Let me do it, okay. And you can shut me down if I get going too far in the wrong direction. But Micah 6:6-8, and this is a topic where the three of us would likely have slightly different perspectives, and I think my perspective would be slightly different than either one of you. It has to do with the meaning of the cross. You know, liberals tend to get pretty angry that God demands a pound of flesh, and I could give you lots of examples by that. The point that I want
Who
to make—
Who actually says that?
Well, it's usually—
Is that a straw man or not?
I think it's articulated by those who think that's what they hear.
See? Oh, okay. Okay. I'll let it go.
Okay.
I'm just going to say, when you say that, it sounds so unattractive.
Oh, I know. I know. And I've been in conversations where it is a straw man. You know, God demands a pound of flesh. Well, where does it say that God demands a pound of flesh? Yeah. It doesn't actually say that. What I would like to suggest, and this is where it'd be interesting some reaction for you, that the demand for someone to pay the price is a human demand, and God knows that. So he provides the sacrifice. It's kind of like if I get an invitation from someone to their home for dinner. I feel, we really need to pay back, you see. And so that sense, when God pays the price back, then that takes care of it. But it's a human need required more than a demand. Let me read it for you here in Micah 6:6-8. Because it reflects the psychology of substitution, which God takes seriously. But there is one place in there when he gets through from going up, well, what can I do? Well, let me just read it here first of all, Micah 6:6-8. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. In the psychology of benefits, you go from, well, do I need to give a bicycle? Do I need to give a Volkswagen? Cadillac? Rolls Royce? And the Good News Bible actually puts in there, no, he has shown you what is good and what does he require of you. Now, see, God knows that psychology, and he came down here and lived and died to solve that thing, but I would like to argue that it is a human demand as a result from sin, not where God is demanding a pound of flesh. Now, I'd like for you guys to talk back to me. We only have a short amount of time, but I'd be interested in your reaction to that.
Well, I'm not sure that really this passage is dealing with that issue. It seems to me that this is not talking about atonement particularly. This is talking about the kind of life.
Yes, but how is atonement related to that, see?
Well,
is it talking in substitutionary terms?
No, it's talking about an offering. Anyway, I hear what you're saying exactly. I just don't read the atonement into this passage.
In this particular passage.
In this particular passage in the way that you see it.
See, I can see some connection to the atonement, but I tend to resonate with what you just said, John. This is, you know, this verse 8 in particular is a remarkable verse. You could almost say that it is the equivalent of Jesus' summary statements of the law. Mm-hmm. That this is, he's told you what is good. And by the way, what does the Lord require? That's an interesting thing. We sometimes think the Lord has no business requiring anything, but it's very plain here. He wants justice. He wants us to love kindness. He wants us to walk humbly with God. Mm-hmm. And I think if this became a guiding text for life.
He's talking about what kind of worship mm-hmm. does God want. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when I come before the Lord, what does he want from me? And he's saying, you know, this material stuff, I don't want. Mm-hmm. I want your heart. That's what I hear this saying.
Yeah.
And maybe you can relate it to the atonement, but I see it's tangential.
Yeah.
I see that this is more directly related to when I worship, what kind of worship does God desire?
But how do those things get produced in human life, John?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, justice, kindness, and humility.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I would say that when God provides a sacrifice on Mount Moriah, that is the first gift. It is God who provides the sacrifice. Abraham, you can't give your son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we can say that, but this passage doesn't go into that. Yep. But you're taking it, and it's right. It's okay.
Next week, we talk about Habakkuk. Thank you, John and Dave, for your contributions, and Chad, for your work as our program engineer. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.